From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look at perhaps the most powerful leader in the Christian right, James Dobson. He's the subject of a new book called The Jesus Machine. We'll talk with the author, Dan Gilgoff, who's also a senior editor at U.S. News & World Report. He's been covering how the religious right has been influencing politics, including the Republican and Democratic presidential primaries. We'll talk about that, too. Also, music critic Milo Miles looks at how the Trucks fit into the history of female rock bands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James Dobson is perhaps the most powerful leader of the Christian right, more powerful than Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson ever were, according to my guest Dan Gilgoff. He's the author of a new book about Dobson called The Jesus Machine, How James Dobson, Focus on the Family, and Evangelical America Are Winning the Culture War. Gilgoff is a senior editor at U.S. News & World Report and has been covering how the Christian right is influencing current politics, including the Democratic and Republican presidential primary campaigns. We'll talk about that a little later. Gilgoff says James Dobson's organizational empire provides the national armature for the modern-day Christian right, like the Moral Majority and Christian Coalition had done in earlier decades. Dobson is a child psychologist who in the 1970s started the radio show Focus on the Family that dispenses biblically based family advice. It's now on about 2,000 stations in the U.S. Dobson also took the lead in founding the Family Research Council, which Gilgoff describes as the premier lobbying group for the Christian right. Dan Gilgoff, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the group James Dobson founded, Focus on the Family, which you know, has been his home base?
Sure. Focus on the Family was an organization that was launched by James Dobson as a radio show in 1977. Its first hires, and it was a Southern California show, were what he calls correspondents, women who would answer the phone calls and the letters coming into from his listeners that were asking about issues involving their family, from an unfaithful husband to kids that were using drugs. And over the last 25 years, the organization has really grown around that dynamic. That is, James Dobson's listeners calling or writing letters, or these days emailing. Focus on the Family gets 10,000 emails each month asking what James Dobson thinks about family topic X, and that really explains the most of the work of the ministry today.
So what you've described is basically, you know, advice shows and advice-oriented operations pertaining to family. You haven't described a political radio show. So does he have a political base through these family-oriented advice operations?
Well, the fact that the political shows are a rarity that Dobson does, and that the political work of Focus on the Family is a small fraction of its overall work, is really what gives Dobson unrivaled, either currently or historically, power within the Christian right movement. And so the paradox that's created is that, for the most part, Dobson doesn't talk politics on air. For the most part, Focus on the Family doesn't engage in at least kind of outright political advocacy. But to the extent that they do, they do it more effectively and more powerfully than any previous Christian right leader organization, precisely because they have this relationship with who they call their constituents, their listeners, and the people that they correspond with, that is totally outside the realm of politics. And so when Dobson or Focus attempts to transfer or parlay that relationship with its constituents, and right now its mailing list is almost 3 million strong, it's remarkably effective precisely because it's not a relationship that's based on politics. It's much deeper than that.
So he's used this mailing list to get out political messages?
Yeah, he uses his radio show. Every time, it's pretty fascinating. Every time, for the most part, that he does a political radio show, he always frames it as being a departure from what he'd rather be doing, and as almost an unscheduled interruption into what was previously planned. So, for instance, a show about talking to your kids about adolescence, about coming of age and human sexuality, that show will be James Dobson will come on air and say that show has been postponed until the next day because there's an urgent matter that needs to be discussed. And so it's always framed as kind of intruding on the issues that he'd rather be talking about, rather be focusing on the family.
Now, James Dobson also co-founded a group called the Family Research Council. Describe that group.
Family Research Council was co-founded by James Dobson in 1983. It was really a small Washington lobbying outfit through the 1980s until Gary Bauer, who was the chief domestic policy advisor for Ronald Reagan, came to the organization in the late 1980s after the Reagan administration was over. He arrived in 1989. that year, Family Research Council was actually rolled in to focus on the family because it was really struggling. By the time that Gary Bauer left a decade later, and he had left to run for president in the year 2000, it had grown to become, you know, had a $10 million budget. It had over 100 employees. And really, in the wake of the demise of Christian Coalition in the late 1990s, after Ralph Reed's departure in 1996, Family Research Council became the most powerful Christian right organization in Washington and remains that to today. And it's very closely tied to Focus on the Family.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Gilgoff. He's a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. And his new book, The Jesus Machine, is about the Christian right focusing on James Dobson, who many people consider to be the most powerful figure in the Christian right now. You say that one of the ways that James Dobson's way of operating compares to, say, Ralph Reed in the days when Ralph Reed ran the Christian Coalition, is that Reed had befriended each candidate so that the Christian movement would have an ally regardless of who won, and regardless of which Republican candidate won, is I think what you mean there. Whereas Dobson, you say, took an all-or-nothing strategy. Would you describe that all-or-nothing strategy?
Ralph Reed was a Republican before he was a born-again Christian, and James Dobson is the opposite. He was an evangelical Christian before he became politically active. I talked to Ralph Reed for the book, and you know, he owns up to that. And he had really been raised through the Republican Party. He had become a leader in the Republican Young Republicans when he was in college. He graduated and was very high up with Grover Norquist and Jack Abramoff, names we all know well now in that organization. And so his first allegiance was to the Republican Party. A lot of his credibility seemed to go up in smoke in the 1996 election because he was seen to be supporting Bob Dole, who was considered a social moderate by a lot of Christian right activists. And they were apoplectic that Ralph Reed, the most powerful Christian activist really of his time, seemed to be tacitly at least, and really behind the scenes pretty strongly endorsing and supporting the candidacy of Bob Dole. And so what happens is the year after 1997, Ralph Reed leads the Christian Coalition, and James Dobson comes to town, comes to Washington in 1998, sits down in the basement with a group of about two dozen House Republicans, a lot of whom are very close allies of him, and threatens to leave the Republican Party. And he says that although the Republicans took over 4 years earlier in the 1994 Republican Revolution, the party really, or at least the Christian right flank of the party, had very little to show for it. There had been no real new curbs on abortion rights passed. The National Endowment for the Arts was still up and running. And so Dobson threatens to leave. And it really ushers in this new era in relations between the Christian right and the Republican Party, with Dobson at the helm, of becoming much less compromising as Ralph Reed was, and a much more of a kind of all or nothing, you're with us or against us, if you will, approach.
And I think another example of what you're saying is in 2004, after President Bush was reelected, he basically gave an ultimatum to the president and to congressional Republicans about what they needed to do to continue getting the evangelical vote. What did he say?
He said that he viewed... I talked to him a couple of days after the 2004 election, and he said that in his mind, the 2004 election was really something of a reprieve for the Republican Party, and that if they didn't deliver on his issues and on the issues of the Christian right, that 2 years later, and particularly, especially 4 years later, that is in the course of the 2006 midterm elections, but even more so in the 2008 Republican presidential primaries and the presidential elections, that evangelical voters would stay home.
And what did he do to follow up on that ultimatum?
In 2006, he really actually came to the defense of Republicans, even though he had previously threatened, you know, to kind of leave the party or to at least encourage evangelicals to stay home. And one of the questions that is really raised in the book is, since the Christian right has tied itself so closely to the Republican Party exclusively? Have they painted themselves into a corner? Do they really have an alternative or anywhere else to go?
What was Dobson's role in helping President Bush get reelected?
It was very significant. 2004 really saw the first outright presidential endorsement of James Dobson's career, and it was for President Bush. But even more significantly, Focus on the Family has developed this national state-based network of organizations called Family Policy Councils. Focus on the Family doesn't like to refer to them as affiliates because they're independent organizations with, you know, separate funding structures and separate boards. But they're very closely tied and are in constant contact with Focus on the Family. And if it wasn't for Dobson's affiliation with the groups, they would have had tremendous difficulty getting off the ground. These state-based organizations are really the successors to the Christian Coalition's state chapters in the 1990s. Only, I argue in the book, that the Family Policy Councils attached to Focus are much more effective. And really Exhibit A in that efficacy is that Ohio in 2004 was, of course, the battleground state that wound up determining the election, was won by President Bush by fewer than 120,000 votes that year. And there have been a handful of studies done by academics that show it was the uptick in social conservative and particularly evangelical votes in that state that gave it to President Bush. If it wasn't for the constitutional amendment in that state banning same-sex marriage, that the Focus on the Family state affiliate really had to fight tooth and nail to get onto the ballot, it's likely that John Kerry would have won Ohio. That, and I'm kind of connecting all the dots here, but that effort was largely funded by the group you mentioned earlier, Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., which poured $2 million into the Ohio effort and was able to hire scads of signature collectors to ensure that the constitutional amendment would be on the ballot in Ohio. And that really put Bush over the top. And so in that way, I would argue that Focus on the Family was essential to George W. Bush's reelection.
Now, Dobson has said some very provocative things about gay marriage. You quote something that he wrote in a 2003 Focus on the Family newsletter. I'm going to read that. He wrote, "Most gays and lesbians do not want to marry each other. That would entangle them in all sorts of legal constraints. Who needs a lifetime commitment to one person? The legalization of homosexual marriage is for gay activists merely a stepping stone on the road to eliminating all societal restrictions on marriage and sexuality." And then he also said, "This effort is our D-Day or Gettysburg or Stalingrad." How did gay marriage become such the focal point for James Dobson?
The easy answer was the legalization of gay marriage by the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 2003, enacted in 2004, which really, for Dobson, presented, you know, put the specter of gay marriage, you know, obviously into reality, and which helped rally evangelicals nationwide in really an unprecedented way, and had obviously a huge impact in the 2004 election. But I think the more complex answer is that in the summer of 2003, a group of conservative, really top Christian right activists, including Dobson, met in Washington, D.C., or actually in Virginia, in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. One of the issues they were grappling with at that meeting was that the Christian right had actually been really successful. At that point, presidency was in George W. Bush's hands. The Congress was controlled by Republicans. There was really the first curbs on abortion since Roe v. Wade were being enacted by Congress. But the negative of that, the downside to that success, was that these organizations, including Focus on the Family, had seen their fundraising flatline and in some instances plummet. And there had seemed to be among the evangelical grassroots a certain complacency that had set in. And so in the minds of Dobson and those activists who were meeting at that in 2003, gay marriage to them was something that not only really presented a threat to civilization, to Western civilization in their minds, and signaled the downfall of Western civilization, but was also a vehicle by which they could revive their own ailing organizations and some of their fundraising. And so that was the beginning of this effort on the part of Dobson to convince a lot of skeptics within the Christian right who said, we'll never be able to pass an amendment to the Constitution. It's easier to elect a president, and that's pretty difficult. He steamrolled over those activists, James Dobson did, over the ensuing couple of years, and really turned the effort to pass an amendment to the Constitution into the paramount issue of the Christian right over the last couple of years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Gilgoff. He's the author of the new book, The Jesus Machine, that's about the Christian right with a focus on James Dobson. And Gilgoff is also a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Gilgoff. His new book, The Jesus Machine, is about the rise of the evangelical right with an emphasis on James Dobson. And Gilgoff is also a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. There's a kind of secretive group called the Council of National Policy, and Dobson is a member of this group. And just tell us a little bit about what their function is.
There are a handful of coalitions of conservative activists, particularly social conservatives like James Dobson, that meet, you know, regularly a few times a year. The Council for National Policy is one of them. Its co-founders include Tim LaHaye of the popular Left Behind series, which has sold in the tens of millions to a mostly evangelical audience. And James Dobson is also a member and had been attending since the meetings began in the early 1980s. Interestingly, James Dobson, we talked a little bit about the crusade that he led in 1998 in Washington, D.C., where he really dressed that down the Republican congressional leadership for not delivering on his issues. He thought that the Council for National Policy over that same time period in the 1990s, perhaps under the sway of Christian Coalition, which he saw as way too accommodating to the Republican Party, had lost its spine. And so for his 1998 crusade, he started that with a speech at the Council for National Policy meeting that year in Phoenix, Arizona, and he later delivered that speech in the basement of Congress, which is when he took the Republicans to task, and which really started this entire new era of relations between the Christian right and the Republican Party, because the congressional leadership at that time knew it had to respond to Dobson, knew it couldn't afford to lose Dobson and his followers. And so in the House, a caucus called the Values Action Team got off the ground, which would be regularly in touch with Dobson and other Christian right leaders on a weekly basis and give them a direct pipeline to congressional Republicans and the Republican leadership. And that whole campaign, as I said, that year started at the Council for National Policy.
So the Council for National Policy recently held one of its closed meetings. And the goal of this meeting was to talk about the Republicans running for the presidential nomination. And some of those candidates showed up to address the Council for National Policy. Who are they favoring now? Like, who is the Christian right favoring now? The leadership of the Christian right, that is.
It's a real challenge for the Christian right now, because there's, of the three Republican frontrunners, Arizona Senator John McCain, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, and former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, there's really not a Republican who is a unabashed social conservative or a social conservative that doesn't have an asterisk next to their name. They all have major challenges in appealing to the Christian right constituency. And so there's a debate right now going on within the Christian right and within the Council for National Policy. One of the one of the points of contention is whether to organize among Christian right leaders behind a second-tier candidate, someone like Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, who is a true blue social conservative, in an attempt to catapult them into the top tier, or to take more of a kind of every-man-for-himself approach, by which each of the leaders of the Christian right would kind of gravitate toward the candidate of their choice. Interestingly, James Dobson sat down for the first time with one-on-one with one of the front runners just last month, and that was with Mitt Romney at his Colorado Springs headquarters. So Dobson seems to be appearing to be pondering whether or not he could support Mitt Romney, who has a past as a social liberal, and who, of course, his Mormonism raises some major red flags with the evangelical rank and file. But Dobson is seen to be either perhaps considering supporting a Romney or joining this plan to perhaps catapult one of the second-tier candidates into the top ranks.
Dan Gilgoff's new book is called The Jesus Machine. He's a senior editor at U.S. News & World Report. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Dan Gilgoff about divisions within the Christian right over global warming and other issues. And Milo Miles considers the place of the trucks in the history of female rock bands. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dan Gilgoff, author of the new book, The Jesus Machine, about James Dobson, who Gilgoff describes as the leading figure on the Christian right. Dobson founded the group Focus on the Family and co-founded the Family Research Council, which Gilgoff says is the premier lobbying group for the Christian right. Gilgoff is a senior editor at U.S. News & World Report, where he's been covering how evangelicals are influencing the Republican and Democratic presidential primary campaigns. Last week, Mitt Romney and Rudolph Giuliani addressed the Conservative Political Action Committee, and at a straw poll at that meeting, Romney came in first, Giuliani came in second. Now, at the meeting, we were just talking about, the Council for National Policy meeting, Richard Land, who heads the lobbying arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, said that if Giuliani gets the nomination, evangelicals won't vote. Can you actually envision an election where they wouldn't vote?
One of the most remarkable turnabouts in the evangelical movement over the last 30 years is that, you know, up until the founding of Moral Majority in the late 1970s, evangelicals in this country had really largely withdrawn from public life. And that dates all the way back to the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925, which for the evangelical movement, even though they really won legally the case, was a huge embarrassment and really stigmatized evangelicals. And so in the last 30 years, since the rise of Moral Majority and with successor groups like James Dobson's Focus on the Family, the turnabout has been that evangelicals now vote in higher numbers than almost any other tradition, religious tradition, including atheist or secular Americans. And so it would be difficult to envision evangelicals, you know, staying home from the polls in 2008. I think some of the interesting spin coming from Christian right leaders like James Dobson on the 2006 midterm elections is that the Republicans didn't deliver on their promise to enact more legislation against abortion rights, to push for an amendment to the Constitution that would outlaw gay marriage. And so James Dobson and his allies say that evangelicals were demoralized and stayed home in 2006. But that's not what it's not the story that the exit polls tell. The story that the exit polls tell is that evangelicals still represented about a quarter of the electorate in 2006, but that Democrats were able to peel off a small percent that in close elections put them over the top of evangelical votes and of the votes of weekly churchgoers. I mean, if you just look at Ohio, which is a state we've been talking a lot about in this conversation, Sherrod Brown, who was the successful Democratic candidate for Senate there in 2006, won around 45% of the churchgoing vote. If Kerry would have done that well in Ohio in 2004 among the same segment of the Ohio population, he'd be in the White House right now. And so for Democrats, they don't have to move a lot of these votes to make a really big difference among evangelicals and church-going Americans.
A lot of people think that the Democratic victory in the House and Senate in 2006 signaled that the Christian right had lost power. Do you see it that way, or do you see it differently?
I would actually draw out the exact opposite lesson. Everyone after the 2004 election talked about that election as being a values election. A lot of it for the Christian right was in response to the legalization of gay marriage in Massachusetts and the birth of the amendment to the Constitution to ban gay marriage is a real issue in the evangelical movement. But if you look at the exit polls for 2006, that was also a values election. Only the values this time were about Republican corruption in Congress. And in talking to the pollsters for the Democratic National Committee, for instance, when they saw the numbers shift in the 2 years leading up to the 2006 midterm election, and when they were tracking values voters very closely and evangelical voters very closely, when they saw those numbers start to break for them was basically after revelations of the former House Speaker, Tom DeLay, and accusations and charges against him and corruption, and after the Mark Foley scandal, which occurred just a month or two before the 2006 midterm elections. And so in a way, the 2006 midterms and the shift of evangelical and religious votes were a testament to the power of values and churchgoers in elections. It's also important to point out that John Kerry's religious outreach in 2004 was abysmal, particularly when compared to the machine that Ralph Reed, the former executive director of Christian Coalition, was able to build for President Bush in his re-election in 2004. But John Kerry's religious outreach director in 2004 spent the next couple of years founding a consulting firm that would help Democratic candidates reach out to evangelicals and faith voters. And she was signed up by so many of the successful campaigns in 2006 of the successful Democrats, whether it be the Ohio success of both the Democrat for governor and for the Senate, or for Casey in Pennsylvania. And so I think the Democrats applied a lot of the lessons of 2004 and the failure of religious outreach that year to 2006. And in the places where this new consulting firm called Common Good Strategies, run by Kerry's former religious outreach director, was active, that was those were the states and the races where the Democrats saw the sharpest uptick in evangelical votes and in the votes of religious Americans. And I think it's no mistake that right now, each of the three Democratic frontrunners for president have serious religious outreach operations up and running at this early stage.
And what are they emphasizing in those operations?
For Hillary Clinton, who is widely seen as being a secular politician who's really a boogeyman of the Christian right, they're emphasizing her own active involvement in the Methodist Church and her own faith. In the 2006 re-election effort for Senator Clinton in New York, she had begun donning a crucifix on the campaign trail, and a lot of political reporters picked up on it, and a lot of bloggers picked up on it, and were alleging that this was some type of ploy to temper her liberalism in the eyes of voters by wearing a crucifix. But one of Clinton hired her religious outreach director, who is an evangelical Christian, as one of her first staff hires late last year. And I think going forward, you'll see a real attempt to showcase her own personal faith, to reach out to evangelicals, and to come across as something of a social moderate. She made headlines a couple of years ago when talking to an audience of family planning providers in speaking of the need to reduce abortions. I think you're going to hear more of that language from her going forward.
What about Barack Obama? Does he have a religious outreach coordinator, and what is he emphasizing in that part of his campaign?
He does. He actually just last month hired from his Senate office the staffer who was charged with religious outreach to do the same for his campaign. And with Obama, he has been active in, particularly in the black churches in Chicago, as a community organizer. Those are the institutions through which he did a lot of his work in the last couple of decades. I think he's going to be emphasizing that work. But in talking to his religious outreach director, he's going to be including members of the clergy, religious leaders, in actually forming some of his policy and in advertising that fact that these are people who are not only being approached for the votes that they could promise to deliver, but in the actual formulation of policy, which maybe a couple of years ago in the Democratic Party would have raised a lot of eyebrows. And just a couple of years later now, it's seen as being kind of essential to casting off the reputation of the party for being a party of secularists.
My guest is Dan Gilgoff, a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. His new book, The Jesus Machine, is about James Dobson and the religious right. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Gilgoff, a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. He's written a new book called The Jesus Machine. It's about the Christian right with a focus on James Dobson. There seems to be a split within the Christian right now on several issues, one of which is global warming. There's a group of people on the Christian right, including Richard Cizik, who's the head of the policy wing of the National Association of Evangelicals, who think that environmentalism and global warming are Christian issues. And Cizik is one of the leaders of a Christian initiative to stop global warming. Now, last week, James Dobson and several other leaders of the religious right sent a letter to Cizik saying what?
The letter was to the board of the National Association of Evangelicals, and it really encouraged the board to silence Richard Cizik, this lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for the National Association of Evangelicals, who's been really forthright in recent years and leading the charge to combat global warming and for evangelicals to view it as a biblical responsibility. To him, this is a theological issue to combat global warming. Receiving a lot of flack from titans of the Christian right, including James Dobson and other higher-ups in Focus on the Family Research Council, and some of the state policy councils. And this is just another demonstration, the whole thesis of my book on how Dobson sits atop this national Christian right empire. If you look at the signers of the letter to the board of the National Association of Evangelicals last week, urging really either the silencing or the resignation of Richard Cizik, you know, four of the eight top signatories on that letter are either Focus on the Family executives, including James Dobson, or affiliated with Family Research Council, Dobson's proxy here in Washington, D.C., or one of the state affiliates of Focus on the Family. This is another demonstration of Focus on the Family representing kind of the old guard of the movement and some of its newer voices, including Richard Cizik at the NAE, really going up against a lot of resistance and trying to break out of the mold of social issues exclusively being the province of the Christian right, that is, the issue of abortion and gay rights in particular.
Last year, Richard Cizik was one of the people who drew up a document on behalf of Christians who want to stop global warming. And this is a document that said that stopping global warming is a Christian duty. But James Dobson and several other leaders on the Christian right sent a letter pressuring Richard Cizik to withdraw his name from this document. And Cizik did withdraw his name, although he continued to speak on behalf of stopping global warming as a Christian duty. Why is James Dobson so opposed to Christians working to stop global warming? It's one thing to not work on it himself, but it's another to try to prevent Christians from working to stop global warming. Why does he want to stop that movement?
You're absolutely right. I think that it's emblematic of a fear that the movement is actually gathering steam behind Richard Cizik and some other high-profile evangelicals. I mean, Cizik succeeded in getting figures like the leader of the Salvation Army, the purpose-driven life pastor Rick Warren, who has tens of thousands of members of his Saddleback Church in Southern California. He got some of the major titans of the evangelical movement onto this document. And Dobson fears that in doing that, it threatens to distract in the pews evangelicals from the causes, what he calls moral causes, which he doesn't consider global warming to be. Basically, this hot-button social issues of abortion and same-sex marriage. And so he fears that if the evangelical movement gets distracted, in his mind, by issues like global warming, perhaps even other issues like international human rights or Darfur to a lesser extent, they will take their attention off the fight to end abortion, the fight to oppose same-sex marriage. And those issues, in his mind and to the old guard of the Christian right, are paramount.
If the Christian right is split over environmentalism, what are some of the other issues splitting the Christian right now, and who are some of the people on the side of these new issues?
Rick Warren, the purpose-driven life pastor we just talked about as being one of perhaps the biggest names that Richard Cizik succeeded in getting on the Evangelical Climate Initiative, is a figure who's really been leading on AIDS in Africa, has been basically trying to get his church, which comprises tens of thousands of members, to adopt communities and villages in countries like Rwanda to combat illiteracy, AIDS, poverty. And on those issues, Dobson isn't somebody who's been outright opposing that, but him declining to lend his voice to that movement is something that prevents it perhaps from getting a lot more traction in the evangelical community. When members of the evangelical community want to get mass traction within the evangelical universe. The gatekeeper they really seek out is Dobson. And so in some ways, by refusing to lend his name to the branching out of the evangelical movement politically, he is kind of holding up some of this branching out, and perhaps with his exiting the scene in the next few years, or the next decade, if it comes that soon, it will expedite what I call the kind of birth of the new right. That is a new right that is very conservative on social issues, but that doesn't limit itself to social issues.
Where does Sam Brownback fit? He's a senator who's trying to get the Republican Party's nomination for president.
I think Senator Brownback is really a poster child for the new right. So much of his campaign for the presidency to date has been, you know, fixated on the issues of abortion and preserving one woman, one man marriage. But at the same time, he was a real leader on prison reform in this country, on speaking out about stopping genocide in Darfur. And so he is a guy that kind of straddles these worlds. He's very close to Dr. Dobson and is on his show pretty regularly. And at the same time is in the Rick Warren camp of trying to branch the movement out.
So by watching his campaign, it's kind of a window on that. Might it be a window on that split and where it's heading?
Oh, it is, absolutely. And he's not the only one. The former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, is another one of these members of what I would call the new right. Very conservative and uncompromising on the social issues. Talks about them all the time. But also frames education as a values issue, healthcare as a values issue. And so, again, someone that's also close to James Dobson is on the show regularly, but is in that other camp as well of looking beyond the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage.
Let me see if I could sum up some of the points that I think you've made in this interview, and that is that you think that although the Democrats won in the House and Senate in 2006, the evangelical vote is still very strong, the evangelical right is still very strong, but both Democrats and Republicans are changing a little bit. Like, the Democrats are trying to speak more to the religious vote, and at the same time, the evangelical right is changing direction a little bit. At least the new leadership, the younger leaders within it, are changing direction a little bit, heading a little bit more in an international direction and an environmental direction, and that's causing some division within the Christian right. So you've got change on both sides here.
You do. And there might be more change in once Dobson exits the scene. Dobson is in his early 70s right now. He stepped down from the presidency of Focus on the Family. And there's, you know, questions of how long he will continue to be active. And at some point, of course, he's going to die. And once he exits the scene, it's going to be difficult for the Christian right to produce a leader that is as influential as he is in this day and age, because the movement is so decentralized. It is really comprised largely by very entrepreneurial, non-denominational evangelical churches on the local level, and it's very difficult to transcend all of those denominational lines. And Dobson has been able to do it, and it's taken him decades to do. And so once Dobson does leave the scene, I think that the evangelical movement and its branching out into issues like global warming or combating AIDS in Africa will actually take off even more than they have now, unless the movement could produce a social conservative who is as committed to as Dobson is to focusing on hot button issues. But it's just difficult to see how they're going to be able to replicate his power once he leaves.
Dan Gilgoff, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, thanks so much for having me.
Dan Gilgoff is the author of The Jesus Machine and is the senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. Coming up, Milo Miles on the new band The Trucks and their place in the history of female rock bands. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Four women musicians from Bellingham, Washington, who call themselves The Trucks, have released a debut album of the same name with language and attitude that's not going to get them much airplay on mainstream radio. Critic Milo Miles says The Trucks are part of a long line of female rock bands that know and find their audience.
Let's go out for a ride, pedal on our old bikes. Short or far, I don't care, ride with you anywhere. My youth, young Louvet, en volant, je m'en crash. Chantez pour moi, chantez pour moi.
It wasn't until I heard Old Bikes on The Trucks' debut album that it hit me. They play what I call nursery punk. Sometimes such music literally sounds like nursery rhymes. Other times it's dressed up with guitars and electronics, but still remains very stark and simple. That particular mode in The Trucks' gut-level feminism makes them part of a female rock legacy that goes back a long ways. Although nursery punk has an appealing, chanted simplicity, it's always more bratty than childlike. It signals that while these performers have a sense of humor, they're fighters as well as lovers. This type of stripped-down punk minimalism has been around since the early days with British bands like the Slits and the Raincoats. But the group the Trucks most remind me of are the Swiss band Lilliput, who often managed to say what they wanted with a sneer and a smile, as in their song Ain't You, with its command to take a radio in your life. I can also hear savvy party girls like those in the B-52s in The Trucks. But they're not just old school. Singer-songwriters Kristen Allen Zito and Marissa Moore, who also play keyboards, guitar, and xylophone, along with bassist Faith Reichel and drummer Lindy McIntyre, would not be who they are without the 90s riot girl bands like Bikini Kill and Le Tigre. I must add that there's always been a potty mouth tendency in these bands, and in the hip-hop era of porny Little Kim and Peaches, it's gone into high gear with The Trucks. Numbers like Why The are explicit explanations about how the girls can't get no satisfaction. But hey, they know what sort of boy they like, too, as the song 3 AM shows.
Driving my Mac, 3 AM, I revved my engine when I saw him. Boy in a dress, in distress, that's the kind of boy that makes me arrest.
The Trucks are more than lost and found lust, however. Even their songs that are cast as ominous fairy tales, like the murderous Comeback and the domineering Man Voice, gets back to the oldest truism of rock and roll. Trashing good manners and making a racket can grant motley oddballs dignity, independence, and control of their lives. The Trucks' first cut, Introduction, offers up sundry true or untrue facts about themselves, some poignant, some embarrassing, some mundane, but the crucial lines are these.
You don't know what you're gonna get, but you like it, you love it.
Just as fat power chords and showboat guitar solos will be with us always, I suspect there will always be bands of rebel girls who don't want to sound like the boys and find their way to nursery punk, to the chants and simple chords that say, take us as we are or leave us alone. And if you don't like it and love it, they'll run over you like a truck.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed the debut album from the Trucks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shura. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Rose.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes, by William Ury, author of Getting Past No. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting Confetti, with Martin Freeman, Jimmy Carr, and Jessica Stevenson, on DVD tomorrow. And from Hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from, online or at 800-3-HOTELS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's when I fell for leader of the pack.
Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. After decades away from music, she's releasing her first solo album. We'll talk with Weiss on the next Fresh Air.
He said he came from the wrong side of town.